Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, working on a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech, you want to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And this is episode 17. And wait till you see what we've got in this episode. We're full, jam-packed, with loads of information. Just so much to fit into the hour. It'll be oozing all over the place by the time you've finished. So, without further ado, what's everyone been up to this week?
Well, I've been imaging, updating 15 laptops for a customer. The normal guy does it, he's on holiday this week, and so I got to do it. But the problem is, these are not one of our normal customers, and they haven't got a volume license agreement, so you shouldn't officially image laptops with which are not haven't got volume license keying, because if it's an OEM license, you shouldn't really be imaging it unless you're the OEM partner. But obviously, we're not with this HP kit, so So I don't really want to have to sit there and update 15 laptops or it was a problem of downloading 15 laptops of doing Windows update because it takes the time of just downloading it. So I always wanted to do this. I haven't got around to work. It's actually kind of make an internal Windows update server. So instead of it going out to the internet and going pulling its updates from the internet, I basically set up a WSUS server, which we talked about before. And what you do is you point your laptops or my laptops to that server to download it. So I'll go into a bit more detail. So what was really, really nice is I haven't actually found this out if you can do this yet, is that it was like, you know, like how the internet goes out and it goes to windowsupdates.com or whatever to get its updates. I like it. It'd be really nice if you could like kind of just tell it, like do some like DNS hack so it doesn't go out to the Windows Update server, it goes to WSUS. But I did a bit of Googling, I couldn't find anything about it. So what I did, I just set up a normal WSUS server, what we talked about before about on one of our servers. It's a 2012 R2 server, so it's just a role you install, and you basically just configure it to download all the updates for what OSs you want, and you tell it to auto-approve updates. So basically it means that any laptop that's configured, or PC, Windows 7 machine or Windows 8 machine is configured to speak to that WSUS server, it can download those updates. So like normally with WSUS, you're on a domain, so you use group policy to configure these options, and you tell it where the WSUS server is, how often you want to check for updates, who can install the updates, etc., etc. But obviously, if all these laptops are work group computers, so obviously you can't deploy group policy to them. So I found a script online which is like a batch file, and it basically just puts the registry keys into the registry, which tells it to go to the WSUS server. So it's quite good. So you basically run this script, and it basically stops and starts the Windows Update service. And so it stops the service. Well, I think it actually puts the registry keys in, stops the the update service, and then it starts it again after you did that bit. And it basically goes off and downloads all its updates from the server. So what I did is a little command, if you didn't know, for the competitive command, is if you're running WSUS, obviously it basically checks periodically, or randomly, whatever you set it to pick its updates from the server. It all goes off and checks for updates. But what you can do is you can force it to go to updates, and what you can run is you can run a command which is WAUACLT/detect now. And what that does is basically goes and tells the server, the client, to go to the WSUS server to get its updates. And after about 10 minutes, it will little icon you get down in the taskbar, and it'll say there's updates available. When you click on it, and it says like there's 111 updates to download, and it just downloads the updates really quickly because it's just pulling it directly from the W server and not from the internet. So, but obviously it still takes a lot of time. It still took about 2.5 hours to install. These are like i3 PCs, Windows 7 with like 4 GB RAM. So it took like 2 hours for it to go and install like 111 updates after. So it had Service Pack 1. It just really annoys me that it takes all that time to download, or not to download the updates, but to apply them. I mean, Andy, if you have to do a rebuild, do you have to kind of do you find that like it's like 100 and so many updates that you have to do after it's got Service Pack 1 on Windows 7?
Yeah, I was going to say it is annoying that it takes so long. I was going to ask as well, why were they so far out of date in the first place?
Well, these are brand new laptops out of the box.
Oh, right.
So they're out of the box, Service Pack 1 on them, and then...
Well, that actually makes you think, you know, when were they actually imaged in the, you know, in the factory?
Yes.
You know, I mean, obviously that was... How many updates?
It was about 116, I think it had.
So what does 116 updates equate to in terms of time?
Well, it took about 2.5 hours to actually install them.
No, what I mean is, how many updates have Windows given introduced? Is it like the last 2 years worth of updates or something?
I'm guessing it's since Service Pack 1's been out, basically.
Since Service Pack 1, yeah. I mean, sometimes I re-image a machine from its own factory restore on its own hard drive. And those ones, then you have to put in every single update after that, so 100 and odd updates. So I generally do that and give it back to the customer already fully updated. Unless I know the customer and he's a little bit savvy and he knows what's going to happen, you know. He knows that they're going to install and take a bit of time to do.
I was going to ask you, Andy, about that. Yep. Like, you know, like on the Pudnuts app, they always go on about, like, are we getting, they do like a tune-up for the server or a tune-up for their PC after. What do you do any tuning up on PCs before you give it back to the customer? Because I want to know what people do. Are they just basically saying you Windows updating it, updating all the applications, clearing people's logs out, temp files, making sure things like Acrobat Reader are up to date, Flash is up to date, running a defrag or something? Is that what they're talking about when they're doing a tune-up kind of thing? Or
a tune-up on a... Yeah, I mean, you've got two different ways of looking at this. You've got a tune-up, which is, a machine that hasn't been touched by anybody, you know, for a couple of years a lot of the time. They haven't done any Java updates. They haven't done any Flash updates. They haven't done anything at all. Plus the fact the whole machine's generally full of junk. A lot of junkware gets installed. Quite often there's malware in there as well.
Yeah.
Nobody's defragged anything. It's basically had no maintenance. You click on anything that comes on the screen and say yes to everything. So an awful lot of stuff gets installed. So a cleanup would be, you know, getting rid of all that crap, getting rid of all the programs, getting rid of all the malware. I use D7 for doing most of that.
Okay.
Because that's pretty much automated. And then once I've done the cleanup, then I start applying updates. So if there's any Windows updates that are out of date, I get them done. And quite often Java's out of date when I get them, so I make sure that that's up to date. Flash Player's up to date. Adobe Player's up to date. Anything else that's running on the machine. Because any software that's out of date has vulnerabilities in it. Especially on Acrobat and Flash and Java, especially. But then there's also what we call a new machine. So somebody buys a new computer. And you get rid of the junk off that as well. Because a lot of machines, you know, from the manufacturer or from PC World or whatever, come with so much crap already installed on them. They really do. So we get rid of them. and often as well on a brand new machine, like you've just experienced, there's a load of updates that need to be done.
There's loads of, I call it bloatware. That's why I normally like to blast a machine, put the OS back on, and then we kind of update it and then image it. I was going to say, Jerry, did you hear about that, the Anovo laptops, which have got this spyware on them, the Snapfish?
Yeah. I've seen that, yeah.
Oh, I've heard a bit about that, but I haven't investigated it.
Right,
really.
So what it is, look, there's a man in the middle of the attack. So it's basically they're placing ads into your browser. To do this, they basically are putting a certificate on your machine, which your machine's trusting. So this is like how they do the SSL. This is how you scan inside your SSL traffic. So like someone saw a blog post on it that if you go to like the Bank of America site and you go to the SSL certificate, it says, it doesn't say like bankers it or like done by you or the SSL certificate. It says it's SSL certificate Snapfish or whatever. So very naughty.
I was going to ask, actually, going back to those i3 machines.
Yeah.
Were they spinning disks or SSDs?
Spinning disks.
To see that SSDs will probably speed up that whole.
That's
process.
The problem. If you're using a laptop or my desktop is just like SSD, and you have to use a machine which hasn't got an SSD, and it takes so long.
Mm. Well, I mentioned a few episodes ago that a friend of mine's got this really rubbish laptop, but I got her an SSD because her old hard drive died, and like it was something like a 80 gigs or something for. Not much. I can't remember how much it was. 50 quid or something.
Yeah.
I had the choice of getting her like a sort of 25 quid spinning drive or a 50 quid SSD, and I just said, "Put the SSD in, and then when the laptop dies, keep the hard drive and put it into your new laptop because you can get a cheapish laptop with a spinning drive, and just." Bung in the SSD, and off you go.
It's a good idea. I mean, a lot of people don't need massive amounts of storage. That's what I find.
Mm,
I mean, so some people do. They save a lot of music or movies or whatever. But I find a lot of just people who are just using the internet never save anything.
Mm.
They don't need, big hard drives.
Yeah.
That's one of the downsides to SSDs, though. Although they're getting better and better, they're still smaller and still more expensive than the equivalent spinning disc. And when you speak to Joe Bloggs in the street, you could say, here's a terabyte spinning disc for 50 quid, say, or here's a 250 gig, quarter of the size, SSD drive, which is, I don't know how much they are at the minute, 100 quid or whatever.
Yeah.
And they'd say, oh, get the bigger one for less.
Yeah. But then try them both in your laptop and see which one you like then.
Yeah, then try them. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a massive, massive difference.
I'm gonna upgrade my computers in the house soon, and I'm going to get I'm going to put SSDs in them, and I've got a NAS with a 2 terabyte drive in. And I'm going to get a 4 terabyte drive for that, or actually 2, and put them in RAID. That's where all my storage is going to be, on this NAS. And then I'll have nice, fast computers, and it'll be great.
That's how I like it. That's how I'd like it, yeah. The SSD for your operating system and any frequently used programs. And also, as well, if you're working on a lot of files, say for example this, like doing the audio editing on here, you do put the audio files on the SSD drive while you're editing them.
That's
to make sure you've got enough plenty of space for temp files and stuff like that. And then have a big drive, either internal or on a NAS drive for all your storage stuff, big movies, because they don't need to be. They don't need to stream fast, do they? If it's audio or movies. But
it's all sequential access as well, rather than random access. Yeah.
I was going to go back as well to know the images we were talking about before, and doing the updates. When I'm not using an image or loading a laptop up from the factory settings, I have Windows install files on a USB drive, which is basically a copy of a Windows disk. And the beauty of them is you can slipstream all the updates or any missing updates onto the USB drive. So instead of say you're doing a clean install onto the hard disk, instead of booting from a CD, you boot from a USB drive. It goes through exactly the same procedure, but every Windows update up to date is already pre-installed onto the USB drive. So by the time Windows is finished installing, there's basically no updates left to do. I use that quite a bit. And I also slipstream some other stuff on there as well, so I don't have to install them. Now, after you've installed the operating system, there's always a few extra programs you want to put on there.
Have you used that Nanite program before? Is it Nanite or Nanite?
Nanite. Yeah. Yes, I have, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I've used that as well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's good for updating as well. It's not just good for installing from scratch. You can actually go there to update.
Yeah.
So, you know, so you go there. Say you've got Skype already on your machine. When you've got the list in front of you on Nanite, you can still select Skype. You can select Adobe Reader. You could select AVG or whatever you've got. And then it checks, have you got the latest version?
Annoyingly, it doesn't do Flash, because I was going to use that on these laptops. No. I need to install Flash and Java, and it says, no, we can't do Flash.
Can't do Flash. That was explained on a Mike Tech show.
Yeah.
Maybe a year or so ago now. And it's something to do with Flash. So Adobe didn't want the installation file accessed by a third party or something.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
They can't automatically make you download McAfee, whatever it is, as well. You've seen that when you update Flash. It's always ticked. That McAfee security thing, isn't it?
Well, that's how a lot of people get a load of junkware and bloatware onto the machines.
Yeah.
They try and install... And what's the other one? I think Java tries to...
Yeah, there
was ask.com and
Ask Jeeves, I remember that, yeah. And it replaces their default search engine on a browser. And
most people just click, when they're installing something, just click next.
Hmm.
You know, and what you've got to... I tell my customers to look at the tick boxes, see what it actually says before you click next, because it's so easy just to end up with a load of junk on your machine.
So what have you been up to then, Jerry?
Not a lot, really. Doing more stuff with mail servers, which might talk about later. A bit more stuff I've actually been doing some stuff with Puppet at work, which is a configuration management software, which maybe we'll talk about that in a future episode. So that's what I've been doing at work. And funnily enough, I've been doing updates because my sort of regular customers, freelance clients, I sort of update their servers once a month, all the update packages. But with Linux, it's a lot easier. It's just generally all the packages are managed by the package manager, and you just sort of issue a single command, you know, on Debian it's apt get update, and then apt get upgrade, and it just goes through and it will just update all of them to the most recent version.
Yeah.
And on Red Hat it's or CentOS it's yum update. And because they're all managed and they all come from the repositories of the people that make the Linux distribution, it's just one shot, really, one command, and it's done. So you can even get packages for Flash and Java and so on to do that easily. So It's all good in the Linux world.
So what have we been doing with Puppet then? Anything good?
Well, there was a... where I work, there was a bit... We had a bit of a disaster with Puppet. I managed to delete a little bit of data, a little bit of company data using Puppet. Well, I didn't do it. I told the machines to do it and they did it. they've been very wary of Puppet, but recently they sent all my team on training, and so because they spent all that money, they actually want to get us using it now. So there's so much stuff you can do with it. Basically, all these little bits of configuration that you would do by hand, you sort of code it, and you know, your machines effectively configure themselves, and hopefully in the process you don't tell them to do something bad. So I think what we're looking at the moment is how to sort of test these configurations before rolling them out, because that's really important. That's what we've been doing, and not really much to report, but I've been using virtualization to kind of try and get that test thing set up. Yeah, that's mainly what I've been looking at this week.
Cool. Okay. Well, I've had fun with certificates. I've been doing quite a bit of certificates as well this week. You might have heard me talk about a product called System Center Operations Manager, SCOM, I call it, nickname it. And if you want to monitor it, it monitors your Windows servers and stuff, a bit like, well, there's a monitoring side of it. To monitor devices on the same domain, it does use AD authentication. But what you can do is you can manage other domains. But obviously, if you've got no trust in between it, there's no way of trusting it. And what happens is you can use the way it works. You use certificates, and you have to generate a certificate for that for the remote server. And you have a thing called a gateway server. And you authenticate that server using a certificate to your SCOM server. And then that authenticated gateway server can then go out and do all your monitoring for you on that domain. But the problem is that because it's your own users, like we've got our own CA internally, the certificate had run out. So we had to regenerate the certificate for all these sites we were looking after. The problem was is that once I replaced it, it still wasn't working. I was going, why isn't this certificate working? And like, you look in the event view and it said, before you change the certificate, say it couldn't authenticate properly. But what I didn't realise is there was a second certificate on the actual SCOM server you need to actually update as well, and that had expired. So as soon as I updated that SCOM certificate or generated a new rekeyed it, had a new expiry date, boom, SCOM kind of started working again, which is yeah. So I spent ages trying to work that out, and it was just because of the SCOM certificate had expired. So that was quite interesting. The other thing I've been doing is about SSH keys. One of our customers needed someone to come in and drop some files on the server. So they wanted a solution. They're not Linux orientated, and so they didn't want to have a Linux book, so they wanted to have something that they could use. So they were using this Ipswitch software, which is an FTP, which is basically FTP with SSH in it, so it uses port 22. And it's like what was it called, Jerry? What was it when you can basically use certificates for authentication, can't you?
With SSH, you don't use... I think you can use certificates, but generally you don't. It's just a public-private key pair.
Yeah.
So you generate one key with two parts.
Yeah.
And then you can put the public key... The public key can go anywhere, and then you basically... Without going into too much detail, how it works is you present the private key to you present the private key to the server which has a public key on it,
yeah,
and the two kind of match up and you're allowed in. And the idea is that you can't reverse engineer that private key if you have the public key. So you can put the public key anywhere you like. You can make, you can put it on the internet if you like for all to see.
Yeah.
And your private key will still be secure.
Yeah. So what I've said is that what I've written in my notes is that public key authentication is a key-based authentication. Is a method of authenticating instead of using password authentication, meaning you don't have to give away system passwords to third parties. Public keys pair exists of two parts, a public key and a private key. The public key sits on the device server which you are connecting from. In my case, this is the client customers who are sending a file. The public key from the client sits on the server and is assigned to user accounts who is dialing in to transfer the file in. When the remote server connects, it sends a message encrypted with the private key. My server decrypts the message with the public key to confirm that the remote sender is says who it is, and that the message which is sent from was sent was encrypted with the private key of the remote server. Because it kind of does it, doesn't it mean that, like, I saw someone in the office this week. If you've got a public and private key, I get this right, if you've got a file and you encrypt it with the private key, anyone with the public key can decrypt it, can't they?
That's right. Yeah, it's like having the public key is like a padlock.
Yeah.
So anyone can take the padlock and lock the data at their end.
Yeah.
But then only you with the private key can unlock the padlock.
Yeah.
So that's effectively, that's an analogy, but it kind of gets the point across.
Yeah. And then, as well, if you wanted to encrypt something which only you could access, you would basically encrypt it with the... So say someone's sending something you wanted, they could encrypt it with your... So you basically encrypt it with your public key, and the only way you can decrypt it is by using the private key.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So, yeah. Also, we point out that the first time an SST client connects to an SFTP server, the SFTP server is basically presented with a host key fingerprint before the public key authentication happens.
Yeah, so that's just something that gets cached on the client side.
Yeah.
So it gets cached on the client side, and you say, I accept that. And what you might find is if you ever reinstall that SSH or SFTP server, in fact, what you will find is you get a new host key. So if you could have the same server, but say you reinstalled the software or reinstalled the whole OS, you'd end up with a different host key, and the client software would flag that up and I mean, in some cases it says, you know, this is a man in the middle attack because I don't recognize this host key.
Yeah.
So it's a way of confirming that it uses this cryptographic methods to do that. So
yeah, because the people who were sending this file want us to send us our host key, because there's no way of, because you know, when you first connect to SSH server, you can say yes, I know that host key. But because their authenticated message didn't do that, I had to send them a copy of my host key.
Right.
But also, it means as well, if someone ever hacks your server, or someone pushes your traffic to another server, and they haven't got your host key, so that it will warn you that you're not connected to your host server. Interesting, yeah. I noticed a blog post the other day on DigitalOcean where they were putting out an image, their Linux images, but they weren't changing the SSH key, so every server they had when they were imaging it out had the same they had the same host key, because they weren't regenerating it, which is a bit naughty.
Yeah, I think good old Steve Gibson highlighted that on one of his podcasts. Yeah, so yeah, it's not good because.
I haven't heard them mention that on the on TechSnap yet, because I guess that's because they're a sponsor of the show.
Yeah. You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah. So also, I had an interesting one this week where another one with Exchange 2013. Insta, one of my colleagues were working with. And 2013 is all configured by a web browser now. There's no management console. And when they were finding, when they were going into some of the user accounts and editing it, the properties, when I clicked OK, it was coming up with an error message. And it was because someone had put a forward slash, in the OU name. So, yeah, be careful. Don't put slashes in your OU names. So it's like it must have been obviously saving it, and it was trying to refer to it in the when you pass it through the post back in the through the website or the management. Obviously, it didn't like the backslash in that request. So, don't have a backslash. You emailed me this week, Jerry, about that you wanted to know about my MikroTik I was running at home.
That's right, a snazzy router. Rather than the sort of crappy ones that the ISP gives you, we were talking about one at Ogcamp, weren't we?
Yeah. So, yeah, I've got, it's a nice little router I've got. It's got 8 ports on it. Four of them gigabit port. Oh, no, I think it's actually got 10 ports on it. I think five 1 gig ports and 5, 10, 100 meg ports. And it's really good. It's all done by command line, or you can do this winboxing. But you can do everything like VLANing, SNMP, monitoring, VPNs. And it's all like a Cisco box, so you can do all the protocols. It's really, really good. There's loads of people out there. There's loads of tutorials and stuff. The only thing that's annoying is the firewall on it. It's got in and out rules, and it takes a bit of getting your head around it. And I can never remember. I have to kind of look it up. So the only annoying thing is that you don't get it doesn't got an ADSL modem in it, which is not a problem for me anymore because I've got a fiber. So you just plug your fiber modem into it. So you will need some sort of little PoE router. So it will basically just do the pass through. So that'll do your syncing. That'll do your ADSL sync on the router, and then it will then. You will then use the PoE client on the MikroTik to do the authentication. Then it gives your public IP address to the actual the MikroTik, and then you can obviously get then you do all the NATing and everything neatly on the MikroTik. It comes with my one hasn't got wires in it, but they do a wireless model now, but they only do the 2.4 gig, not the 5 gig. And also, it's got this nice little LCD screen on it now, which mine hasn't got. So,
what is that 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz? What's the significance of that? Does it allow more devices on the?
If you live in like a populated area, 2.4, you're seeing it's like use all the bandwidth up, and you know, like if you've got these channels, they will get used up, where like if with the 5 gigahertz there's loads more channels, but it doesn't go so far the distance wise. So I'm running 5 gigs here because we all live in like these timber built houses, and all the traffic goes through the walls really easily. So unless you're in a really populated area, it doesn't really matter, kind of thing. So
yeah, I'm out in the middle of nowhere, so should be all right for me. I was actually, I heard on Security Now again about those ADSL modems. And apparently this one sounds all right because it bridges, effectively, you end up with the public IP address on the inside, if I'm correct. Whereas with some, it makes a network in between the sort of inward-facing side of the ADSL router and the WAN side of your chunky router, you know, that is like a little network there, and you can get an attack which goes via the browser to this ADSL modem and does nefarious things there. So something to watch out for, maybe. But I think the one you mentioned sounds okay because it sorts out the network. It effectively bridges that network.
Yeah, I think it's called a little ADSL bridge, basically. So it basically presents, so it's a PoE client that gives you the public IP address on your firewall, onto the firewall.
Which is what I'm doing. A router is a different IP on either side, whereas a bridge is the same IP effectively.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'll put a show note in the link to that and the little... I use a little SolarWise SAR router, which, yeah, costs about a tenner off eBay kind of thing. And I put a little bit of custom software on it so you can do your own little thing on it. So, what I was going to say, Jerry, is I wanted, I don't know if you know much, I was just wondering about how... You were talking about mail servers last week and how you put... so we were talking about, what was the mail? Was it like Qmail or something, or what was it?
Postfix.
Postfix.
This is kind of industry standard now, I think. Postfix is the SMTP server, so if you're talking from a point of view of you sitting at Outlook or Thunderbird or whatever, to send mails, you talk to the SMTP server directly from that mail client. But then the SMTP server actually then sends, it contacts other SMTP servers to get mail going around the internet. I can go talk a bit about that if you like. So with any domain you want to use mail with, you'd have an MX record. So that MX record points to the SMTP server for that domain. So you can have other service, other providers providing that mail functionality for you. But if you're running your own, you might have a postfix server sitting on that IP address, that MX record IP address. And so what it does is your SMTP server wants to get to from your SMTP server on domain1.com wants to get to joeblogs@domain2.com. So what it does, it goes to the domain.com and then it looks up the MX record and it'll get this IP address and it goes, right, so that's where I send the mail for joeblogs at this domain. I send it to this IP address. What a lot of people do, they're not running one mail server per domain. They're running one mail server which serves lots of domains, and that's called virtual domains, at least on the postfix side. So you can have, fluffybunnies.com, fluffykittens.com, all served on this one mail server. And that's all handled by postfix, or the SMTP server that you're using. So the mail arrives at that receiving server, and then the receiving server will have logic about where to deliver that mail to, and it will take care of delivering the mail into the mailboxes for users on all of those domains. So joeblogs@fluffykittens.com or whatever will have an account on there, but it's a virtual account, and generally that's all held in a folder structure on the server, which at the other end, at the receiving end, you'll have a mail client again probably, and then that mail client will talk to either an IMAP or a POP3 server in order to reach those mailboxes, download the mail. So in a nutshell, that's it. although the SMTP server, the postfix in this instance, that's where all the spam filtering, virus scanning and so on will live as well, and generally that's a separate process which the mail server will then run the mail through effectively, to do all that good stuff.
So postfix is basically MTA then, the mail transfer agent is what we're saying.
That's right, yeah.
So is there SendMail, is that another kind of...
Yeah, that was the old standard, but it's famous for being really hard to configure. So
okay, but postfix is the way forward, is it?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, SendMail was standard on Red Hat until quite recently, and I think they went to postfix.
Okay, so just to understand, so you got the mail that comes in. So is there like configuration trips? What say like for this domain? put it into this folder kind of thing, or for like,
yeah,
and like, can you like set folders up and stuff in that script kind of thing? I'm guessing there must be kind of scripts or the config files that tell it.
Yeah, it's generally a config file, so there'd be like aliases for, you can have aliases for different users, so Jane blogs at fluffykittens.com could be alias to Joe blogs, so that's just like a pointer.
And then like to get my head around it as well, so does a user account, do you have to create a Linux user account for every user on that server then?
No, I mean that's where the virtual domains and virtual users comes in. I mean, you do, at the end of the day, you have to create the user on the virtual domain, but that often sits in the database these days, like a MySQL or Postgres database, just to tell PostFix what to do with the mail.
Right.
And where to, effectively, where to put it on disk at the end of the day. So where does this mail have to end up? And then the IMAP or POP server will then take care of actually delivering that mail to the end user.
Yeah. And then you reckon you use it some sort of else, another bit of software, like whatever, Dove or something, to do the IMAP or whatever side of it.
Yeah, so that'd be Dovecot, Cyrus, Courier, all these servers, which basically they know about this folder structure as well.
Yeah.
And when the mail client comes in and says, where's my mail? Here's a password and so on. It can point them towards the right place and they can download the mail. I should also say, at any point on this process, you can add encryption as well. So you could add encryption for the IMAP server or the PostFix server. And there is a setting with PostFix where you can say, encrypt it. If it's available at the other end and you can encrypt it end to end, do so. But otherwise, just send it in the clear. I mean, I think a lot of mail is sent in the clear these days, which obviously isn't ideal, but there you go.
So what version of PostFix are we on now? Is it?
Oh, that's a good question. I'll see if I can check, actually. And that's the other thing. A lot of Linux boxes will be running PostFix. They'll just be running it because that you can send directly from most Linux machines.
Yeah.
You don't need the SMTP server. You can just... They'll have an SMTP server running, so I might have a go at doing that one day.
I'm quite interested in that. And that's one of the hardest things you can do on Linux, I think. Unless someone can show me how to do it, it's going to find it hard.
There's a lot of steps to know, and I don't really know the IMAP POP side, but yeah. I know pretty much all the rest now, so that's something. 2.9.6 is what my server's running for PostFix, so that's I don't know when version 1 came out.
And this is another question for you. So let's say you run. So if you did, let's say they release a load of security updates and they get obviously put down the chain, and you type in app update. Yeah, update, and then obviously downloads the updates, and you say update upgrade. Those updates get automatically upgraded. Yeah.
Yeah.
What happens if they release version 3 of PostFix? Will that just get... Would that get pushed down like that or not?
So that depends on... It depends on distribution. Like, if you're on something like Debian, that'll stay... Or Debian Stable, that'll stay on the stable one and you'll just get security updates.
Yeah.
And then when you move to a new version of the OS, that's when you sort of get the major version jump.
Yeah.
But if you're on something like Arch or Gentoo or one that's sort of more cutting edge ones,
yeah,
you generally get the updates as and when they arrive. But it's all down to the distribution maintainers to decide when these versions go in. They sort of pull in the things as they're released, compile it from source, and then decide whether or not to put it in, do all the testing and whatever, and if it's good to go, then they put it in.
So we've talked. Okay, well, I thought we weren't going to have to talk about it tonight. I was going to. I was doing it in the week. I was trying to think, what should we do on this podcast, really? And so I put a thing out on Google Plus, and a couple of people were personally emailing me saying, can we talk about backup software? So I think we might talk about backup software next week. I wanted to like do the things between the different types of backup software. So you've got your classic backup software in the Windows world about like backup exec, NT backup, which is kind of like your firewall, and then you go and get the ones about Veeam. I'm going to do some research for that, and then we can come about that next week. I mean, is there something you can talk about on your side of Linux thing, side of things there, Jerry?
Yeah, I mean, I'll bring something next week, don't worry.
And I'm guessing, Andy, you were saying about you want to explain how to explain it to your customers, isn't it, kind of thing?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I've just said, because now you're in a different situation to what I am. But, I go and see people who have no backup whatsoever.
Yeah.
And I've got plenty of different stories of this. No backup whatsoever. And so I start to say, right, you need to get a backup.
Yeah.
You need to have this. You know, basically explain what can go wrong if you don't have it. And that's really followed up by how much is this going to cost?
Yeah. So and I'm guessing the same people as you is that they only want to do it once they lose a file or something.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, and I can say what I've done, and you could maybe say what you've done. You know, because I know you've done like pricing for people and things like that. And you know, how do you justify the backup methods, the cost of it? And justification to them that they are safe and happy in the knowledge. There's been a few people who say, well, you just need some kind of backup. If anything, you just need a portable hard drive plugged in.
Yeah.
And to do it, you know, and they say, well, how much is that going to cost?
Yeah.
You know.
Okay, we can talk about that a bit. Yeah. But I mean, I've always been in my first job in IT, it was like drilled into me, backups, the first thing you check. Start of the day. And the other guy, someone on the Google Plus, mentioned that he wants us to talk about help desk software. I don't know what kind of, if you have any, we only obviously get what I have exposure to in my previous jobs and what we're using at the moment. I don't know if you need to use anything at the moment, Jerry.
We've got an in-house, my employer's got an in-house thing based on Lotus Notes, and it's terrible. It's really bad. So we can discuss that. I can moan about it for a bit.
Yeah, I think it's definitely kind of thing we can look at that. So we can look at what the pros and cons, what you need to do, if you know what I mean. So that'll be for next week, I think. Or if let me email in it. Listeners, email in. What do you want to know about help desk software? Have you got, what software do you run? Got any tips? Kind of thing. Because the main problem we have is with our software is that help desk software is normally designed for one company, so like for your internal company, whereas us has multiple customers you have to look after, and that's where it starts to get a bit confusing. So so email us in what you, any suggestions, what you use out there, because he was mentioning about OSKIT or OS Ticket or something as an open source help desk. I might try and get that on the server and we can have a bit of a play with that before we talk about it. Also email us in if you want us, what you want us to, if there's any subjects we haven't covered yet and you'd like us to talk about. We'd really like to hear from you, really.
Might even make us do a bit of research. I mean, I had to research that mail, that mail thing I just babbled on about a few minutes ago. I actually went and did some research before the show, so I knew what I was talking about.
We talked quite a lot tonight about different things. I've got different things. Okay, we'll get the emails in, haven't we? From, was it Dave or Dean or someone?
I've got a couple of them. There's one, I don't think I said who it's from. but I'll read the first one.
Florida.
The Florida one, yeah. Right, so he says, love the show, guys. I wanted to share a free program with you that I use called HFS. It's a little free little server program from rejecto.com. It's an exe, so no need to install. Just click on it, open it, and drag and drop a file onto it that you are sharing, and you are sharing that file on the web. I have been serving files with HFS for about 5 years now. I have a little PC running all the time just for it. I've had well over 1.5 million downloads with it. That's good. It's great. You can have single files. You can use folders. Folders within folders, hidden folders, browse-only folders, password-protected folders, upload folders, and more. If you don't want to constantly serve files with it, you can use it to send single large files. Just start it, drag and drop the file in, and send the link to whoever is downloading it. When you are done, you can delete the file out of it and close it. Keep up the good work, and thanks for keeping the show clean. That sounds. I don't know if anyone's used that program at all.
Nope, I haven't used it, so be careful with it. Then just check it. I don't know, I haven't used it. It sounds like a good little program. It's come a little niche or something. So, and then the same guy emailed back. I think it was Dave. I think his name was.
Was it Dean?
Dean.
Dane, wasn't it?
And he was talking about a security flaw in this four leaked VPN user real IP address. I looked into this, all about this WebRTC. And it looks like WebRTC is a way of communicating between two PCs through a Google or through a web browser, and it's not going by a third party. So like normally like things like Skype or Google Plus, it goes, your communication is going by a third party. Whereas this is actually, it kind of like talks to each other. And so it talks to each other directly over a VPN. And you're chatting directly to them. You're not going by a third party. And apparently there's a flaw in it. And it basically gave your public IP address out if anyone was snooping the traffic. There's a fix for it, so we'll put that into the show notes. So, and I think he was asking as well about if we had any suggestions for any music podcasts. And I'm definitely going to say Rat Hole Radio. I know you mentioned it last week. I was listening to it in the car on the way home from work. It was a good little tune. So kind of
it's
like
really good, isn't it? There's just all kinds of stuff on there, and he just has a really good ear for a tune, isn't it?
And he doesn't really care about if it's common. He doesn't kind of seem to care if it's not Creative Commons or whatever. He kind of just plays with it.
Although it is, on the whole, it's Creative Commons, isn't it? But there's just such good stuff out there that doesn't make it to the normal radio. It showcases them.
It was definitely kind of catchy, wasn't it? So.
And you know, if you miss Linux Outlaws, you can at least get Dan Lynch on the Rat Hole Radio.
I hope they're going to come back.
Get Dan Lynch fix.
Yeah, I hope they're going to come back soon with their new show.
It's Geek News Radio, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Come back, guys. We miss you.
Good. Anyone got anything else to say? I think I've covered all my what I wanted to talk about. Oh, do you want to talk about... Oh, you wanted to talk to me about virtualization follow-up stuff. We've got a couple more minutes.
I just had a couple of questions on that on last week because I'm doing Linux stuff, Linux virtualization stuff at the moment.
Yeah,
I've got this little dual core box, which I've got about 8 VMs on. They're only one CPU each, one core each.
Yeah,
but you know it's not busy. So what is the general, idea then? Because they're only little test VMs.
Yeah,
I assume you'd want at least one core per virtual machine.
Yeah, got to remember with virtualization is it's more of the RAM what's the killer more than the CPU, unless you've got something high processing like some not even database, because databases are normally in memory, aren't they? But if you're doing some sort of like mathical conversation, mathematical calculation. It's when you're using your CPU, and you basically you can really oversubscribe your CPUs because you just get a share of the CPU cycle. Is that right, or the CPU processing? So normally it does kind of thing. What I find out, like I've got 8 gig in my memory at home. In my server, that's what you run out of first, and you get a thing called ballooning, where it can't write to the memory, so it gets put to disk. It's a bit like whatever you call it,
virtual memory.
Yeah, virtual memory. So that's what you're thinking. And VMware does it really well. Hyper-V doesn't.
Okay, I think the Windows team at work, they're going from Hyper-V. Well. There was a guy there, and he did loads of stuff with Hyper-V, and they're moving it all over to VMware again.
Yay.
So, what you were saying last week?
So CPU, a real world example, just chooses a cycle, and like normally, like a machine, if it's not idling, doing anything, it's not using CPU processors, so it gets given to someone else. So basically,
yeah, and I think modern OSs are pretty good about, you know, chopping up CPU like that. I mean.
Yeah, so the more processes, I mean, we get things like these today with like 12, like each CPU's got 12 cores inside of it kind of thing, so.
Yeah, and that was my other question actually about hyper-threadings, which effectively gives you virtual cores, doesn't it? So it kind of gives you two virtual cores per physical core, so you end up with ridiculous numbers of CPUs in some servers. But only half of them are actually there, so.
Yes. So you don't hear much about hyper-threading these days because you can normally get them enough cores in the processor you want. So, hope that.
And you said I think it's on by default hyper-threading on most servers. So we have to turn it off on our servers because it affects the processing because it's all really fine-tuned algorithms and stuff. So you have to make sure you turn off hyper-threading, otherwise they do.
Some of the processors you don't get hyper-threading with these days. It depends what Intel processors you buy. And you say about this lone sysadmin. Yeah. I haven't heard that blog before.
Yeah, no, it's really good. He talks about virtualization a lot. I first read his blog when I was looking up something about Nagios, which is open source monitoring software. But he writes a lot about virtualization basically, and he did a post, it wasn't actually on his blog, but he did a post about what to look for in your storage, in your virtualization storage, and all sorts of things like deduplication and things like that. So yeah, worth reading. He knows
because
stuff.
there's a guy called the yellow bricks, and that's all about VMware. So that's also a good interesting thing. Because he was talking about, because VMware 6 comes out this month or next month. So there's lots, I need to look into that at the work. So I'll be a lot talking about that. And also been doing a lot of work this week about upgrading 4.1. So current version of VMware is running, the latest version gets 5.5. I think it's like up to update 2. And again, with Microsoft, they've got the end of support for Windows 2003 coming in the end of May sometime.
Yeah.
4.1 is like for first. So you got 4.1, 5, 5.1, and 5.5. 4.1 is actually out of support now, and is actually out of telephone support. So you can only get support via the web interface, by doing like a web email chat with them. So we've got to upgrade this customer from 4.1 to 5.1. And they can only go to 5.1 because this back-end storage is only supported on 5.1 because it's an old HP EVA. And they only go to 5.1 because basically this is cool bit of technology with HP port called 3PAR. And they're trying to get everyone to buy 3PAR. So they're not basically developing the EVA anymore, so that everyone then goes and buys this nice fast free pass stuff. So the problem you've got is if you go from 4.1 to 5.1, there's a new feature, which is a point I talk about in a number of podcasts, is a single sign-on, and I haven't really done much with it. And it's basically the authentication method has changed between 4.1 and 5.1. So that will be interesting. After next week, I've done a couple of installs. I'll be able to talk about it a lot more. So there we go. Okay, anyone got anything else to say?
No, not me.
Yeah.
Good. All right. Okay, well, as always, you can email us at mail@adminpodcast.co.uk or... you can find us on our Facebook page or our Google Plus page. We still haven't sorted out a Twitter page.
Twitter account coming soon. Watch this space.
We say that every week. Okay. So, guys, hope to speak to you all soon.
Okay.
Yeah.
See you next week.
Yeah, good to see you.
Bye now.